Hi, I'm Giancarlo Esposito, and I'm here to introduce you to my new series, Parrish. My character, Gray Parrish, was a getaway driver.
I'm retired from life. You know that.
He's in a world over his head.
Tell me about this driver job.
And he's asked to start to figure things out.
I did what you told me to.
He will try to do what's right and seek justice.
Parrish, all new Sundays at 9 on AMC and stream on AMC Plus.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Too Much Information is a production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Too Much Information, the show that brings you the secret histories and little-known fascinating facts and figures behind your favorite TV shows, movies, music, and more. We are your two teen detectives of trivia, your filthy beatniks of fascinating bits and bobs, your Great Danes of great decisions. I'm Alex Heigl.
You're meddling kids of key points?
I guess that's fine.
Yeah, it's passable. And my name's Jordan Runtog.
And today, Jordan, we're talking about one of the great American cultural legacies of the 20th century. Not homophobia or institutionalized racism or trickle-down economics, but rather Scooby-Doo. Since September of 1969, Scoobert Doolittle, that's not actually his name.
I think oh,
it is Scoobert. It's Scoobert, but...
Scoobert Doo.
Scoobert Doo, his loyal human companion, Shaggy, and the rest have been taken to a stinking windowless van called the Mystery Machine to solve various real estate and petty theft-related crimes. The initial animated series, Scooby-Doo, Where Are You?
Question mark or no question mark?
You know, I've been Googling so many different spinoffs of this show. You could just tell me it was called, like, Scooby-Doo Electric Boogaloo at this point, and I'd be like, yeah, that's what I spent 6 hours. No, it is, yeah, it's got a solely an exclamation point without a question. Stupid country. That originally aired Saturday mornings on CBS, lasted 2 seasons and 25 episodes, but from that original seed, over a dozen different TV series and specials, 2 live-action movies, 25 direct-to-DVD movies, and over 20 video games were born. Kevin Sandler, an Arizona State University professor working on a book about the show, considers it the most spun-off show in television history. What do you say about that?
I mean, that scans. Like we were talking about before taping this, it just, when you mentioned Scooby-Doo, my first thought was just, what of it? Like there's just, it just seems to be this giant wall of media.
He's like the Liberty Bell or Rocky.
Or something that's not in Philly, yeah.
The cheese steak. No, wait. I do remember watching this growing up. I think I saw a lot of the Hanna-Barbera stuff when it was on reruns in various different places. I definitely remember Space Ghost. This, Super Friends. And then in my teens, they started getting recycled into the stoner comedy stuff that Adult Swim was doing, like Space Ghost Coast to Coast and Harvey Birdman, Attorney at Law.
I was a big C-Lab 2021 guy.
Yes.
Was that your...
With my penchant, my youthful penchant for spookery, I loved that Scooby-Doo and his pals were on the surface concerned with vaguely supernatural situations, even if they always turned out to be an old white man in a rubber mask.
That's the true dark heart of America. It's always an old white man in a rubber mask. Was there ever one where he's wearing like a Nixon mask, like that crime movie? What was that movie where they're all wearing like presidential masks? And
Point Break, baby.
Point Break. Oh, yeah. That's the one.
Just watched that movie recently. Still holds up.
You know, I didn't really watch Scooby-Doo very much, despite the fact that it has all the hallmarks of things that I love, which is like toothless 60s psychedelia, mysteries, and just sort of a generic mid-century cred. I was more of a Flintstones Jetsons guy when it came to the Hanna-Barbera collection, their oeuvre.
Those are the ones that I found boring.
Yeah, right. I mean, again, that scans. I also say, and I'm afraid to the waters that I'm about to wade into right now, I sort of have a thing against cartoon dogs for some reason, and I know that this is in the DSM-5 under the entry for bad person or sociopath. I'm aware of that. But I really think there was a scene in, I think it was in All Dogs Go to Heaven, that Don Bluth trauma trigger movie from the late 80s, where some dog like eats pizza really disgustingly. And I think in my young mind, it came down to, well, do I want pizza to be ruined for me or dogs? And I think I just made the judgment call of, oh, I'm just going to decide to hate dogs as a result of this. Not dogs, cartoon dogs.
Yeah, I mean, you're objectively wrong. Lady and the Tramp, Oliver and Company. I mean, come on, dude. Peanuts? Like, Peanuts. You hate Snoopy?
That's a different kind of dog, though. I guess I'm talking about, like, big, like, Balto-like dogs.
Balto and Marmaduke.
Yeah, and the dog from All Dogs Go to Heaven, which I think was like a German Shepherd.
Yeah. Yeah, so you just don't like large animated dogs.
Maybe it's because I grew up with Doberman Pinschers.
Oh, God. What, did you grow up in the SS?
I used to ride them. They were huge.
Yeah. No, I guess I get that, but I don't know. You're on your own there, yeah, as far as you know. Well, from the show's roots as counter-programming to the perceived violence of other Saturday morning cartoon programming, to the detested Scrappy-Doo, to the role of Old Blue Eyes in the creation of a famous cartoon dog, here's everything you didn't know about Scooby-Doo. So fast forwarding, or rewinding back to, Jesus, I don't even know what direction time goes in anymore. Rewinding back to the late 60s, as hilariously quaint as they may seem currently, some of the slate of the iconic Hanna-Barbera cartoons you may know were actually quite controversial for their perceived violent content. You know, at this point, with the influence of sci-fi and I think particularly the Batman show that had been going on, a lot of Saturday morning cartoons were derided as just being excuses for like action and biff, bam, pow stuff and not being sufficiently educational or gentle. Part of this was due to the tenor of shows that were being broadcast. One was particularly bizarre. It was called Super President, a show that depicted the national commander-in-chief as a secret superhero ready to battle any threat. As milquetoast as that sounds, the National Association of Broadcasters derided it as an all-time low in bad taste. NBC was responsible for this direct ideological approach to totalitarianism. We fear there may be other broadcasters who are irresponsible enough to keep it in circulation. Pause and realize a time when people were concerned about the creeping representation of fascism in American media. But many people were also appalled that the show was broadcast not even 4 years after JFK's assassination.
Not faster than the speeding bullet.
I was waiting to see if you were going to take that one.
It was there.
In 1968, a grassroots group called Action for Children's Television, or ACT, was founded by Peggy Charon and a group of housewives and mothers in Newton, Massachusetts. And they chose as their target not only the content of the crop of Saturday morning cartoons like Space Ghost and Birdman, but the number of commercials broadcast during these shows, which was actually, on average, found to be almost double the number of commercials that were allowed during so-called adult programming.
That's wild. That feels wrong to me.
It was something like 9 minutes in adult programming and then 16 in kids programming.
Oh my God. Wait, per hour or per half hour?
That was per hour. Sorry.
That's still really crazy. Wow.
Yeah. So ACT and others of their ilk put enough pressure on broadcasters to not only cancel a huge swath of these cartoons by 1969, but also to drastically cut down on the commercial time allotted. Plus, by the time that Scooby-Doo aired in 1969, the country had weathered 1968, which, as any time capsule television special worth its salt will tell you, was a transformative one in American history. What with the Vietnam War, the riots of the Democratic National Convention, and the assassinations of Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr.
That's
good. Also sub in. Thank you. I pride myself on my Fogarty. You might also sub in footage of soldiers trudging through Vietnam to the sounds of dun 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 dun. Yes, that was all along the watchtower, the maximum legally available use that we can.
Yeah, seriously.
Demand for more family-friendly TV content resulted in the bizarre moment in American history when Bob Montana's Archie comics achieved multi-platform cultural domination. Not just content in their mastery over the print, the Archie gang had to also take over the TV airwaves by Filmation's animated series for CBS, and then the nation's radio waves via their hit that you may remember called Sugar Sugar, which was written explicitly to capitalize on the monkeys, and topped the pop charts in 1969 for 4 weeks to become the highest selling single of the year.
That's insane. It beat out songs by the Beatles, the Stones, those first Jackson 5 singles, Elvis, David Bowie, Stevie Wonder. I also found out this afternoon that Wilson Pickett does a version of Sugar Sugar, which...
That poor guy.
Yeah.
We had him do it all kinds of shit by the end of his career. We really beat that man down, which is something considering he was a boxer.
Sugar. Honey, honey, you are my candy girl, and you got me wanting you.
There's a sneak case for this f***ing Archie comics being like maybe the most influential comics in history with this music situation, all the stuff that was copying off of them in animation, and now with Riverdale having had like a 10-year run and launching a bunch of now famous actors.
Wow.
I'm not going to make that argument, though. I don't think I've ever read I think when I was a kid into comic books and people would be like, hand me an Archie comic, I would like stealthily throw it away behind their back.
I liked them because I thought that they had ties to the 50s and 60s, and I was obviously into all that.
Yes. Yes.
It's kind of my bit.
Yeah. So the Archies were the brainchild CBS's head of daytime programming at the time, a guy named Fred Silverman, and his next move was to envision a cartoon that would cross the popular 1940s radio program I Love a Mystery about three detectives, the 1948 comedy horror movie Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, and the 1959 sitcom The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis about a scatterbrained teenager and his friends.
Fred Silverman, I feel like he cropped up in something we did recently. I can't really remember what, but he's a big deal because he was one of the only TV executives of that era, the 60s and 70s, or maybe even any era, to work at all three major networks, CBS, ABC, and NBC. And the late, great SNL writer Michael O'Donohue ended up getting fired from SNL for skewering Silverman with a sketch called Silverman's Bunker, which is kind of legendary in SNL comedy nerd circles because it compares the flagging NBC network to the last days of Germany in World War II. Silverman's Bunker obviously being a play on Hitler's bunker. And I don't think the sketch was ever aired and he was fired for it. But Silverman, on the plus side, he also gave us All in the Family and Charlie's Angels. So I give him a pass for that. Time Magazine called him the man with the golden gut in 1977, which...
That's a weird...
Didn't mean what I thought it meant.
Yeah.
Nope.
Should have gone back to the edit. Silverman told METV Legends that, "I had always thought that Kids in a Haunted House would be a big hit."
it's so executive brain. That's like something vague and unoriginal. I think it would be great. And I mean, to his credit, it was, but...
He said, "As a kid, I would go and look at Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, movies like that. I was convinced that this was going to be the biggest hit we'd ever had, even though nobody knew what the hell it was."
What? So where's that coming from? Like, what are you basing that on?
Bro, his gut. Let the man cook. So Silverman farmed this project out to Hanna-Barbera rather than Filmation this time, and producers William Hanna and Joseph Barbera consequently kicked it down to a team that included writers Joe Ruby and Ken Spears, as well as artist Iwao Takamoto. He had come to Hanna-Barbera from Disney, where he worked under one of the company's legendary nine old men of animation, Milt Kahl.
I actually don't know much about this nine old men thing. I think you've mentioned it on a few episodes where we touched on animation or Disney stuff, and it sounds fascinating, unless they're old men in rubber masks. I mean, not, I don't want to put you on the spot, but what is the deal with the nine old men?
So they are basically the people who are responsible for like a half century of animation. And that was a nickname coming from Walt himself that I think came from Nine Angry Men or something like that. The core nine was in place by the time that Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs came out in 1937. And the last one of them left after the Great Mouse Detectives in 1986. So fully...
Wow.
One of them was in place for 50 years of Disney. And they were collectively, either as producers or directors or animators, responsible for basically every Disney animated film that came out in that time. They, because of the way Disney worked at the time, they'd be working on multiple projects at once. And obviously there were nine of them. So you're talking everything from Cinderella, Bambi, 101 Dalmatians, on way up through all of this stuff. But one of their bigger legacies is as educators, because two of them published a book called Disney Animation, The Illusion of Life, that really laid out the company's approach to animation with like nine tenets of how they animate and draw characters. And then when Disney died, when Walt died, a huge chunk of his trust went to funding CalArts's character animation program. And a bunch of those guys taught there. And then basically the generation of animators that came up through the late 70s, and we're talking about guys like Brad Bird and Tim Burton and those guys, they came out of CalArts, and then usually either out of CalArts or just somewhere else, a lot of them were apprentices of different members of the Nine Old Men.
I feel like animation, more than so many other areas of filmmaking, or maybe it's just more visible, relies more on mentorship and apprenticeships than a lot of other things, a lot of other, you know, areas of production that I can think of. Maybe it's just the, like, you know, they're more mythologized and high profile.
Yeah, I mean, it's it seems a very insular world. I think it's like SFX in that way.
I was just gonna say,
guys who know guys.
Thank you for that. I love how much you know about animation. It's that, and like special effects are two things that I know absolutely nothing about. And I love
just
the depth that you go into.
Movie magic.
Movie magic.
Baby. I love movie magic. At Disney, the animator Iwao Takamoto, who had been in an internment camp for the duration of World War II, he worked on a lot of the stuff. He worked on Cinderella, Peter Pan, Lady and the Tramp, Sleeping Jesus. Beauty, 101 Dalmatian. And then when he came over to Hanna-Barbera, other than Scooby-Doo, he worked on the Jetsons. And he also co-directed Hanna-Barbera's 1972 adaptation of Charlotte's Web. So did you know that? That the guy who drew Scooby-Doo directed Charlotte's Web?
I didn't know that.
It'll get more granular. Don't worry. Wait till we get to the Manson family. The trio's initial conception for the show was called Mysteries 5 and featured five teens: Jeff, Mike, Kelly, Linda, and Linda's brother, WW, and their dog, Too Much, who were all in a band called The Mysteries 5, even the dog who played the bongos.
The dog was called Too Much?
That's correct.
So was this some kind of terrible one-note psychedelicized version of Who's on First, where there was like, you know, that's too much, man. Oh, I know, baby, but what's the dog's name? Like, you know, that kind
of? Yeah, or okay. Something like, they've taken too much.
Oh my God.
Yeah. The kids learn about Narcan.
Oh, so yeah. Wow, that's terrible. That's worse than the Golden Gut.
So between their musical gigs, the gang was out solving spooky mysteries involving ghosts, zombies, and other supernatural creatures. As is pretty much obvious to anyone who cares about this kind of thing, the character who became Shaggy was a straight ripoff of Maynard G. Krebs from The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis. He was the stereotypical bongo-playing beatnik in that show, and they basically just made him a hippie.
He was played by Bob Denver, who later played Gilligan from Gilligan's Island. And I kind of always assumed that Gilligan was Maynard G. Krebs, who'd like grown up and like to make money, being a hippie, just like lived by the water and did the 3-hour tour just to make some money during the day. That was my unified theory of Bob Denver.
Well, it's the shared Denver cinematic universe.
Yeah. Did you ever watch The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis?
Absolutely not.
Oh, it was a really good show. Well, I had Tuesday Weld on it, and I had a big crush on Tuesday Weld.
There it is.
There it is.
Refining the dog concept, though, took work. They were torn between the comedic possibilities of a large cowardly dog or a small feisty one, and settled on the former, though eventually that counterpoint would be used for the much-hated Scrappy in the late 70s. Initially, they were concerned that a Great Dane would be seen as a Marmaduke ripoff. They presented a sheepdog version to Fred Silverman, who, in turn, concerned that the dog would then be compared to the Archie's own sheepdog, told them to change it back to a Great Dane.
What would you have done? Would you have done a small feisty one or a large cowardly one? I see you as a small feisty.
You mean me as a dog?
Or no,
well, how I would have developed the show?
Why can't it be both?
I think it would have been funnier if it were a cat. Because cats are useless. So you could do all kinds of throwaway gags about them being like, hey, you know, Miss Mittens, what do you think that is? And the cat's just like staring intently at a corner.
Smoking a cigarette.
Yeah. Just... So that's my take. Scooby-Doo should have been a cat.
Again, we're going to start elevator pitching sequels right now. This is good. We're
the
such
ultimate
good,
reboot.
We are such good executives.
Sadly, we are.
We are. I know. The animator Takamoto created Scooby-Doo's features after finding out from a Hanna-Barbera co-worker who bred Great Danes what made for show-winning features on these animals. Takamoto told Cartoon Network, she showed me some pictures and talked about the important points of a Great Dane, like a straight back, straight legs, small chin. I decided to go the opposite and give him a humpback, bowed legs, big chin and such. Even his color is wrong.
Hilarious.
Yeah.
I love to imagine that coworker's seeing the finished product and was like, what? This is all wrong.
Maybe thought it was an insult to like the dog she was breeding too.
I hope so. I mean, all that stuff is why they're dead. Like, don't live past the age of a second grader at this point.
Oh, the inbreeding or the fact that they're huge? It's like that movie My Giant.
Inbreeding. It's like any of those breeds, like pugs or German Shepherds. They've all been so inbred that for specific features that they can barely function.
Like the Windsors.
Yes, very much so.
No, can we not? I don't know. I don't know the health status of half the royal family right now. I love how they're going like Frules of Pruder on that poor woman's like family photo.
Oh yeah.
Like I saw people Instagrammed, like I swear there were like 15 points on this damn photo of like irregular pattern, fingers that don't line up. It's just like Jesus Christ. So that is the look of the creature we now know as Scooby-Doo. But how did the beloved canine get his name? Well, it came from show Godfather, shall we say? Grandfather, Scooby-Doo grandfather,
yeah,
Fred Silverman, TV executive Fred Silverman, the guy who thought that kids in a haunted house would make for a winning combination. The idea came to him on a plane. He said, I booked a red eye and I couldn't sleep. He's talking to the Television Academy. I'm listening to music as we're landing. Frank Sinatra comes on and I hear him say, Scooby-Dooby-Doo. It's at that point I said, that's it. We'll take the dog. We'll call it Scooby-Doo. It's hilarious because that's not what Frank Sinatra actually says. In reality, he sings Shooby-Dooby-Doo. And it's at the end of Strangers in the Night, I would assume. Shooby-Dooby-Doo. Yeah, okay. So the writer Mark Evaner, who would write several Scooby-Doo teleplays and comic book scripts, told the Cartoon Review that the name Scooby-Doo came from a different misheard lyric. The 1963 teen doo-wop hit Denise by Randy and the Rainbows. Chorus goes, oh, Denise, Shooby-Doo. I'm in love with you, Denise. Shooby-Doo.
Was that song sung in a grating Frankie Valli-esque falsetto?
Yeah, actually.
Okay, yeah, that's what I thought. Oh, Denise, Shooby-Doo. I'm in love with you, Denise, Shooby-Doo. Right?
That's actually, that's fairly enjoyable coming from you, I have to say.
It sucks.
I'm going to loop that
Frankie Valli should have been the only guy allowed to do that. And Smokey Robinson, a couple other guys on Motown. That's it.
Brian Wilson?
Absolutely not.
I think Frankie Valli's retiring soon. We should see him.
Yeah, why not?
Great Italian American.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bing bong.
He goes on Mount Rushmore.
Yeah.
Him, Marty Scorsese, Frank Sinatra, and me.
We got movies. We got podcasting. We got music. What's a great Italian American on the TV?
On the TV? Yeah. Oh, James Gandolfini.
Oh, yeah, there you go. All right. Very good. We got him. Good.
All right, good.
Good Italian writer, Mario Puzo?
I think it's like Mario Puzo.
Yeah. So, all right. So we got the dog. We got how he looks. We got the name. Now we got to have his damn kids around him. The animation team whittled down their initial concept from 5 to 4 teens, and they called them Jeff, Kelly, Linda, and WW, the most unwieldy series of initials. And they eventually became Ronnie, Daphne, Velma, and Shaggy. Getting closer. And these took fairly explicit inspiration from the aforementioned The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis.
It really is wild when you see them, like especially Daphne, just like the plaid skirt sweater look. Like, it's just...
It's Tuesday obscene. Well. Yeah, it's Tuesday Well.
Completely stolen.
Well, it's Hanna-Barbera would do that. The Flintstones was the Honeymooners.
Honeymooners, like, yeah.
Across the board. Ronnie, the handsome male lead on the show, I get you call him that, right? Yeah. Was renamed Fred in honor of Fred Silverman, the TV executive who soft pitched them this idea. And so there you have the human elements of the mystery team. What the hell are they called? The Mystery Brigade? Mystery Squad? No. Mystery Machine was the car. What were they known as collectively?
Keep going.
What were they called? The Mystery
S Groupin? Scoobin Schwatzen? Scoobin Waffa?
Fred Silverman presented a pilot premise called, at the time, Who's Scared? Several S's with dashes.
Oh, yeah. I should have said the Scoop Staffel. Because that's what the there S
are
stands
two,
for.
There are two S's in that. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. You're right. Huh. To CBS executives as the centerpiece for their upcoming 1969 to 1970 Saturday morning cartoon block. But CBS executives felt that the presentation artwork was too frightening for young viewers, and thinking the show would be equally scary, decided to pass on it. Which is surprising when it was being presented by a fairly high-ranking executive at the network, but okay. Without a centerpiece for their Saturday morning cartoon lineup, Fred Silverman went back to Joe Ruby and Ken Spears, the animation team, and they retooled the pitch to focus more on the dog and soft-touching more of the scary elements. And then they repitched it to the CBS executives, who approved it.
I read somewhere that they took it like 15 rounds, and I'm not sure if that was not presentation, but like drafts of the pilot script.
I mean this with all respect to everybody who... Scooby-Doo seems like a first draft idea.
You don't really think it stood up to 15 rounds of rewrites? I don't know. Come on.
I said this
How many
before
rewrites we... you do on your scripts?
Yeah, that implies that I finished them. I said this before we started taping. I don't think I've ever seen a full episode of Scooby-Doo. I've definitely never sat down and intentionally watched it. This is sort of a... I mean, again, it's one of the things I love doing the show is that it helps me find newfound appreciation for things that I previously ignored. Last week it was you with Billy Joel, and this week we're getting there with Scooby-Doo for me.
Oh, we'll get it out of you.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more Too Much Information in just a moment.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
When you have health insurance, it's easy to think, I'm covered, no worries. Well, not so fast. Remember, your out-of-pocket costs are not covered by insurance. That can be a lot of money for your family. But how do you know you're not being overbilled? It's estimated that over 50% of medical bills contain errors. Unless you're a billing expert, how do you know your medical bills are accurate? HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your insurance. When your medical claims come in, HealthLock technology reviews the claim for errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. HealthLock makes it easy to find and fix hidden errors, so you pay only what you owe. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. To date, HealthLock has helped its members save over $130 million. Bottom line, insurance alone isn't enough. To save, visit HealthLock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider. That's HealthLock.com.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Onto the non-canine parts of the show. Legendary voice actor Frank Welker, one of the most famous voice actors in the industry with over 850 acting credits on his IMDb page, received his first ever cartoon acting voice acting gig. I think first ever voice acting gig, period. I think he said he had done commercials before this. At 23 years young, as the ascot-wearing Fred Jones.
I love how often you shout out the ascot. I love how much you hate the ascot.
It's extremely dumb. No one makes them look good. You just immediately look like a sex pest.
Are you saying that because I recently shared a prom photo of me and my friend both wearing ascots?
I'm not saying it for that reason. You're reinforcing my decision. I could barely read the copy and didn't know which end of the mic was electrified, which explains why shock therapy has no effect on me, Welker quipped to Verbicide magazine in 2006. Joe Barbera was fantastic and really gave me a chance. He would give me the opportunity to read for all the characters, not just Freddy, and that really opened things up for me. Welker has voiced Fred in every Scooby series except for A Pup Named Scooby-Doo. Welker told Entertainment Weekly in 2018 that he didn't even want the role of Fred originally. He was angling for the role of Shaggy because he wanted to do more comedic work, while Casey Kasem, who was eventually cast as Shaggy, wanted the role of Fred for the opposite reason. He was tired of doing comedies. In the same interview, Welker described the voice of Fred as basically my voice, plus about 5 cups of coffee. Welker further recalled to USA Today that the advice he got from Joseph Barbera was literally just, you know, you're kind of the same age. They are not. I think Fred was supposed to be 17. Just do your own voice and think Jack Armstrong, the All-American boy. You're the leader of the gang and you got a driver's license. And that was pretty much it.
That's all it took in the 60s.
A different time. Fred and Daphne's constant breaking off to search whatever they were investigating as a couple wasn't so that the teens could indulge in their normal hormonal urges, but rather because the writers found them so dull that they broke them off as much as they could to focus on the funnier characters. Bizarrely, in a 2012 Reddit AMA, Shaggy actor Matthew Lillard additionally revealed that the original cut of the 2002 Scooby-Doo live-action film had Fred revealed to be gay, hence his love of the ascot. And that Freddie Prinze Jr. had actually portrayed him as such throughout the film. Lillard may have been screwing with everyone, though Prinze has said in interviews that he regrets doing the Scooby-Doo films, only elaborating, there was just too much bait and switch on the first one. The studio was not honest with me in any way, shape, or form. Was he referring to pay or the decision to straight wash Fred? Perhaps we'll never know.
I think I remember hearing that the live-action Scooby-Doo from 2002 was meant to be more winky and like a parody, kind of like the Brady Bunch movies were in the 90s. And then they ended up just playing it straight when they released it in the final cut, in the literal and euphemistic sense.
It took until 1997, though, for the Fred to nod at Fred and Daphne being a couple. And it didn't even happen in their own series. It happened on the show's crossover with Johnny Bravo, Bravo Doobie Doo, in July of 1997. Other team-ups have included with Batman, the Addams Family, the long-running WB series Supernatural, the band Kiss, and multiple projects involving the World Wrestling Federation and then Entertainment, the last of which I cannot find any justification or explanation of. This is actually the second time I've gone down this rabbit hole, because I remember seeing it was like the WWE and Scooby-Doo, like the gang solves the mystery at WrestleMania, and I tried to get more info about it, and I could not. Even the original announcement on the WWE's page goes to a dead link. So, but it happened twice. There's two of them.
Well, didn't the Flintstones have some kind of connection to the WWE? So maybe there's some kind of Hanna-Barbera WWE crossover thing.
Yeah, sure. I didn't know the Flintstones crossed over at one point. That's
Yeah, I think it might have been like a Bam Bam thing. I'm not sure.
That's weird.
What's even weirder, Heigl? Tell us.
Bonus fun fact, on the 1972 episode Wednesday is Missing, a pre-Taxi Driver Jodie Foster supplied the voice of Pugsley Adams. Academy Award-winning Jodie Foster with an early role as the boring teenage son of the Adams family.
Is that funnier, less funny, or equally funny as Billy Joel's pre-fame heavy metal band, Attila?
Oh, it's much less funny.
Okay.
The show's various iterations have since expanded on these rather thin initial character sketches. For example, Daphne was eventually revealed to have come from a rich and privileged background. Although her family money funds Mystery Inc., she forsook the trappings of her family dynasty to forge her own path, thus placing her on the same disadvantaged financial ground as the rest of the gang.
So she's basically the Mystery Gang's Patty Hearst.
That is correct.
Okay.
That is the only interesting thing I could learn about Daphne. She was referred to unofficially as Daphne in Distress for a long time because of her being basically the person that would fall into a trap or get spooked or kidnapped. But I guess she knows martial arts now. They threw second wave feminism a bone. That's the thing with all the timelines of this show. There's like seven different timelines of reboots and things. And I guess in some of them, Daphne has become a badass.
The core Scooby cast assembled in the recording booth where they were encouraged to ad-lib and play off each other, even taking turns voicing different villains from week to week. I like that. Didn't they do that in Aladdin too, and they had the whole cast in a big room together to record, which is pretty rare.
It's pretty rare, yeah. I think the only other ones that do it are Simpsons and Futurama.
Right. Welker, who voiced Fred, recalled that two of Velma's iconic catchphrases came from these sort of quasi-collaborative vocal recording sessions. Velma, he said, who was portrayed by Nicole Jaffe back in the early days, was the one who said, "Jinkies." Then the cast started trying to do our own little things. Mine was, "Hold the phone." Could have gone better there, but...
not great, Welker.
Could have tried harder on that one. Meanwhile, Velma's famous line, "My glasses, I can't see without them," wasn't a line in the script for Velma originally. It was actually something that was said for real by voice actress Nicole Jaffe at the very first table reading, and the writers thought that it was cute and fit the character, so they kept the line. And Nicole Jaffe, the voice of Velma, had been playing Peppermint Patty in "You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown" before being cast as Velma.
As you put it, yes, she portrayed two of the most closeted lesbians in television history.
Cartoon history, yeah. Huh. That's interesting. But she apparently was not happy with getting cast in this deathless, enduring cartoon franchise. In a 2011 interview, she said she was hoping to become a Daniel Day-Lewis-esque actor, and she found voice acting kind of silly. Quote, "It was like getting on a soap opera when you wanted to be in a Scorsese film. I don't know what voice people are like today, but in those days, I thought they were kind of weird." I've heard that. I remember that came up during the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer episode we did, too, that back then... I think now voice acting has a much better reputation.
Yeah, it was Robin Williams who legitimized it, basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in Fern Gully and Aladdin. But yeah, it was a weird sort of ghetto for a long time.
She continued, "Somebody of 40 was playing somebody of 20. Somebody was playing a dog."
But when you break it down like that.
All right, fine. In the same interview, she mentions Lauryn Hill at one point, somehow meeting her at a... I can't even begin to imagine how they would have crossed paths, but apparently Lauryn Hill was a big fan of Scooby-Doo. So that's cool.
I just love that. Yeah.
Do you think that Lauryn Hill went to like some kind of like cartoon, like Comic-Con convention?
I like to think so, I can't imagine that's what that's going to be.
I almost could. It's just weird enough.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Velma's look was another direct rip from the many loves of Dobie Gillis TV show from the 50s. There was a character on Dobie Gillis called Zelda Gilroy, and she was frequently shown wearing sweaters and plaid skirts, and she was kind of a nerd. The most interesting thing about Velma to you is the long-standing coding of her character as a lesbian. Fred and Daphne had each other, as did Scooby and Shaggy. Now, by that logic, Scooby and Shaggy...
Hey, you get your mind out of the gutter, pal.
All right. Velma, according to Matt Lipp, who runs the Scooby-Doo history account on Twitter, Velma, quote, has never really had a main love interest. He continues to the New York Times, she had occasional flirtations and brief relationships, notably with Johnny Bravo in a 1990 crossover. But even when the writers attempted to pair her up with Shaggy at one point, Lip continued, it's something that doesn't feel natural for them both. This guy is really humanizing these cartoon characters.
Hey, that's what you got to do.
Oh.
James Gunn, the Guardians of the Galaxy auteur now running the DC Cinematic Universe, co-wrote the big 2002 live-action Scooby-Doo film and originally turned in a version that got an R from the MPAA. In 2020, he tweeted that Velma was explicitly gay in my initial script, but the studio just kept watering it down and watering it down, becoming ambiguous, the version shot, then nothing, the released version, and finally having a boyfriend, the sequel. The original film's director, Raja Gosnell, said that further retooling and cutting was necessary to get the script down to a PG from a PG-13, explaining that some of the things that they had to lose were some winks to Velma's sexual orientation and more pot jokes. The studio, Gosnell continued to E, wanted to sell the movie to what the current demographic of Scooby-Doo was, and that was young kids and parents. A test screening in conservative Scottsdale, Arizona, didn't play well at all, he said, and that started the first scramble to take out all of the Is Velma Gay references. We just had to do our best to protect the movie and make the best movie we could under newer guidelines.
Man.
And this is funny to me, that there was a scene actually in the film that was shot but cut in which Daphne, played by Sarah Michelle Gellar, and Velma, Linda Cardellini, kiss, which must have fulfilled a lot of longstanding fantasies held by some of the creatives on this project. Sarah Michelle Gellar, though, recalled to Sci-Fi Wire that it was actually a plot device. It wasn't just, like, for fun. Initially, in the soul-swapping scene, Velma and Daphne couldn't seem to get their souls back together in the woods. And so the way that they found was to kiss, and the souls went back into proper alignment, to which I say, sure, Jan.
I have a question for you. How do you get your soul in alignment?
Drinking? Avant-garde jazz?
For me, it's ABBA.
Yeah. All that said, Velma did finally get her queer moment, albeit one revealed retroactively. In 2020, Tony Cervone, the co-creator of Scooby-Doo Mystery Incorporated, a 2010 series on Cartoon Network, posted an image on Instagram of Velma standing in front of a pride flag, writing, "We made our intentions as clear as we could 10 years ago. Most of our fans got it. To those that didn't, I suggest you look closer." Responding to a fan in the comments, he said specifically, "Velma, in Mystery Incorporated, is not bi. She's gay." So, at least one timeline definitively got Velma somewhat out of the closet. Anyway.
Scooby-Doo premiered the year of Stonewall. Like, probably, I think, 3 months after the Stonewall riots.
Oh.
So those are the human members of the gang. Now we got to talk about Scooby-Doo. The voices for Scooby-Doo and the much maligned Scrappy-Doo are all done by one man named Don Messick. Now, Messick is something of a Saturday cartoon icon. Aside from the aforementioned Doos, Messrs. Do and Do, he voiced Bam Bam Rubble in the Flintstones, Astro in the Jetsons, Boo Boo Bear and Ranger Smith in the Yogi Bear Show, Sebastian the Cat in Josie and the Pussycats, Gears, Ratchet, and Scavenger in the Transformers, Papa Smurf and Azrael in the Smurfs.
There it is.
And Dr. Benton Quest in Johnny Quest. So he gets stuck with all the, like, annoying characters. This is, like, the gist that I'm getting.
That's okay. One way of looking at it, yes.
He also voiced a few characters in the first animated adaptation of The Hobbit by Rankin Bass in 1977. Shortly before his death, he claimed that giving up smoking had robbed him of the rasp in his voice that he needed to voice Scooby.
Tragic.
Scooby's speech disorder, which really boils down to his excessive use of the letter R, is called rhoticism, I'm told. I'm now being told. I'm getting something in my ear. Scooby's speech disorder is called, has a name. According to somebody who could probably help me say speech pathologist, Dr. Stephen Long was referred to, quote, Stevie's,
we're suffering.
I would refer to Scooby's disorder as phonological as opposed to a phonetic disorder, in that he shows a pattern of substituting and adding sounds in his speech rather than just distorting sounds. Scooby's error pattern doesn't have a specific name, at least not one that we commonly use in clinical practice. Messick, the voice of Scooby-Doo, told the Asbury Park Press that there was an interesting genesis to his rhotic pattern. Astro from the Jetsons preceded Scooby-Doo, Messick said. I had to come up with what I call growl talk. Joseph Barbera liked things starting with R's, for the dogs especially. He got that from watching Soupy Sales, who was a kids show host. Sales had an off-screen dog. All you would see was the paw, and he would talk with R talk. So Joseph Barbera, decided that Astro should have that kind of attitude. But then along came Scooby-Doo, my favorite voice. So then, when we were doing later Jetsons episodes, I had to pitch Astro a little bit higher, because Scooby had the growl talk, though his was more of a barrel-chested thing. I appreciate the thought that went into this voice.
I just got distracted with adjusting my life goals to becoming the first ever person diagnosed with Scooby speech disorder, like convincing everyone that it just happened to me one day, and then like faking that you'd never, I don't even know what Scooby-Doo is. I've never seen an episode. I've never even read an episode. Rush start rocking like Rish Run Root Day.
No, here's the movie. It's Yesterday, but with Scooby-Doo. Instead of the Beatles never existed, Scooby-Doo's never existed. And then you just start talking like that and you become famous for some reason.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
It's one and the same in 2024. This brings us to Scoobert. Ken Spears, one of the animators on the show, said Scoobert, which was Scooby's Christian name, the name on Scooby's birth certificate. Dogs have birth certificates, right? Scoobert wasn't our doing. He's talking to ScoobyAddicts.com. We don't know who came up with that. We wouldn't have. Co-creator and writer Joe Ruby immediately said after him, neither was Scrappy-Doo. We didn't like him either. I don't know much about Scrappy-Doo. I guess we're going to hear more about Scrappy-Doo later.
He's divisive. He's basically like, if you picked like an annoying, he's sort of like the Great Gazoo in that he's like, is like a late stage addition to try and sort of save the ratings and everything. But he's
Cousin Oliver.
Yeah. And he's like so brash and annoying and brave that it just threw out the whole dynamic. It's just obnoxious. Meanwhile, another fun Scooby fact. The dog is posited as being 7 years old, which is kind of depressing considering that the average lifespan of Great Danes is 8 to 10 years old, meaning that Scooby is spending his waning years hanging out with a bunch of teenagers being scared out of his wits. Fred and Shaggy are supposedly 17, Daphne is 16, and Velma is 15.
Did I send you that on the other show I'm working on, the Paul Anka talk show? We interviewed the singer Tony Orlando, and Tony Orlando and Paul Anka were tight with the Rat Pack, and they knew Dean Martin. Did I send you this clip?
Oh, yes, they did. About how Dean Martin was like, they would see him in a restaurant. He would just be like, I'm waiting to die.
Yeah, they'd go up to Dean Martin at these little Italian places in Hollywood, and he'd just be sitting there by himself towards the end of his life. Hey, Dean, how you doing? Just waiting to die, pally. Waiting to die.
So
that's what that's where Scooby was at.
Yeah, that's true.
That was the tie-in.
And now, friends, we must move on to the true reason of this episode. Casey Kasem as Norville Rogers, aka Shaggy.
That's a name that sounds like he came from money.
Yeah, right. As mentioned, Shaggy was a very explicit ripoff of the beatnik parody Maynard G. Krebs in The Many Lives of Dobie Gillis. And Shaggy, also as mentioned, was not the role that Kasem wanted when he auditioned for the show. When I auditioned for Shaggy, they showed me a picture, so I knew he was supposed to be a hippie, Kasem told Cartoon Research. I combined two voices, sort of an attitude of Dave Hull, who is a disc jockey on KRLA, or the actor who played on Our Miss Brooks, Richard Crenna, whose character spoke in a high, squeaky voice and was always very breathy. It may shock some of you to know, as I do, Richard Crenna, who I am most aware of because he was Rambo's handler in the Rambo movies, was once on a dumb sitcom and talked like this.
I've just finished another article about you for the Madison Monitor. You see, My Favorite Teacher by Walter Denton. It's very complimentary.
Yes, I can imagine. Your last article about me was complimentary to the point of embarrassment. I wish you wouldn't print that, Walter.
No, don't be so modest. Look at the notice I tacked on the bulletin board.
Sounds like Jerry Lewis.
Richard Crenna, man. Friggin' Colonel Troutman. Depressing. Kasem did admit that certain parts of the character came pre-envisioned. They gave me the word zoinks, and having him say, like, I guess, because of the hippie aspect. I did come up with the Scoob, old buddy of mine, old pal, thing. But I have never used the word zoinks ever in my everyday conversation. I'm suddenly defaulting to like a very low and gravitas voice for Casey Kasem, despite the fact that we all know he sounds like a gravelly voiced elf. Total aside, but Joseph Barbera seems like kind of a dumbass. He dispassionately broke down the dynamic between Shaggy and Scooby in an interview with the Television Academy, saying, Scooby would eat anything, anywhere, at any time. Shaggy would eat anything, anywhere, anytime. So you had this competition between them as far as eating. They would eat waxed fruit off the table, those two guys, you know? That became a funny gimmick that the kids must have liked and bought. Otherwise, we wouldn't be going today. Just like the stupidest possible boiling down of that relationship.
Do you think he hates the show? Like
I think he's just I think he's a dumbass. Because listen to his pitch.
I'll give an example of what I'm thinking about that never got Scooby made. If I ever can get to it. I want to do Scooby-Doo Goes to Woodstock. And he and his gang are going up in this little van. And they're a group now. They have an instrument. And they arrive at Woodstock and there's nobody there. Just this dark, empty field. And then the zombies show up. I'm sorry, I forgot. The zombie Woodstock. Mm-hmm. They go to the Woodstock not knowing it's a zombie Woodstock. And these zombies show up. Oh, they're doing this, you know. The whole bunch. And then one arm falls off or whatever is necessary. And then they won't let them go. They want them to keep playing. And they got to out-trick them somehow or other. So it's a perfect vehicle for them. Especially with Scooby jumping in his arms every 2 minutes. You
know? They get there and there's nobody there and there's zombies.
And zombies are saying, you know, whatever it is zombies say, like, oh, trying to grab them. Because, and then they go to leave after they played their set. The zombies don't want them to leave. It's just like a drunk guy like pitching his. I love it. Joseph Barbera, very funny. Jordan, tell us about Casey Kasem.
Casey Kasem wound up voicing Shaggy from 1968 to 1990 nonstop. And in the 70s, Casey Kasem became a vegetarian, and by the 80s, he refused to do any commercials for clients that sold meat, fish, poultry, or dairy products. Oh, wow, he sounds like more of a vegan. It's hardcore. As Kasem remembered, at Hanna-Barbera, I asked the director at the time if it would be possible to quietly make Shaggy and Scooby vegetarians in the series. Which goes with the whole hippie thing. The director of the shows at the time, Gordon Hunt, Helen Hunt's father directed Scooby-Doo for a time, said, sure, Casey, we can do that. So when Scooby and Shaggy had a pizza, instead of pepperoni, they would put vegetables on it. Instead of a hamburger, they would have an elaborate peanut butter and jelly sandwich. The only time Casey Kasem didn't provide Shaggy's voice during this time period was for a couple of Burger King commercials. I said I couldn't do it. It was against my conscience to promote something that I myself wouldn't eat. So I told Hanna-Barbera I couldn't do it. They were willing to understand, after playing Shaggy for those 300 shows and a couple movies, that I turned them down on one commercial. This was, you say, 1995, and Kasem did indeed sit the role out until 2002. Kasem, apparently, at least officially, said that he was unaware of one of the most universally picked up on aspects of the character. Asked by Newsweek in 2002 if he was aware of the subtext that Shaggy was a major stoner, Kasem responded, there wasn't anything like that at all, and quote, we never even thought of it. He added that he never observed anything of his colleagues making a joke about Shaggy smoking marijuana, explaining, I guess it's because, I don't know, it was a wholesome show from beginning to end.
I tried to find that original interview so hard and couldn't. All I have is, I couldn't find the original Newsweek. So just have to take a bunch of other sites' word for it. But
it gets
imagine
some...
being the guy who asked Casey Kasem if he picked up on the fact that one of his most durable creations was a pothead and him just being like straight to your face like, no.
According to Casey Kasem, he said he wasn't even aware of this until the interviewer brought it up to him, which is
hilarious.
I mean, you got to think he's making that up.
Putting a guy on. Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah. But Kasem, who, if one very famous on-air freakout is any indication, I would assume had something of an ego. What was he doing? He was like doing it. Oh yeah, they had like a, he took like a letter about like somebody who was like planning for a funeral or something, and then they like played some like really up-tempo song afterwards and he melted down.
Now, we're up to our long distance dedication. And this one is about kids and pets and a situation that we can all understand, whether we have kids or pets or neither. It's from a man in Cincinnati, Ohio, and here's what he writes. Dear Casey, this may seem to be a strange dedication request, but I'm quite sincere, and it'll mean a lot if you play it. Recently, there was a death in our family. He was a little dog named Snuggles, but he was most certainly a part of... Let's come start again. I'm coming out of the record. Play the record, okay? See, when you come out of those up-tempo goddamn numbers, man, it's impossible to make those transitions. And then you got to go into somebody dying. You know, they do this to me all the time. I don't know what the hell they do it for, but goddamn it, if we can't come out of a slow record, I don't understand it. I want a goddamn concerted effort to come out of a record that isn't a fucking up-tempo record every time I do a goddamn death dedication. It's a god last goddamn time. I want somebody to use his fucking brain to not come out of a goddamn record that is that's up tempo, and I got to talk about a f***ing dog dying.
I enjoy that.
It's so funny because his voice is so like robotic and just like smooth and modulated that when you hear it break containment and start delivering profanities, it's like hearing like Siri start cursing or something.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Guy's got power. So yeah, Casey Kasem, not somebody you wanted to mess with. Guy, he's got kind of an ego. But he was aware that his character, I should say, Shaggy, was second banana to the dog. Scooby, he said, was the star of the show, the Shaquille O'Neal of the show.
Which is hilarious, because depending on which phase of Shaquille O'Neal's career, it gets funnier and funnier. Like, that's Shaquille so O'Neal with the Orlando Magic, Shaquille O'Neal when he was arguably battling Kobe for title of most valuable Laker. Or Shaquille O'Neal, the commentator era now. Like, it just gets funnier and funnier.
Shaquille O'Neal in Kazam.
Yes.
That's how I'm choosing to believe it.
Yes.
Kasem continued, people love animals more than they love people. Am I right or wrong? They give more love to their pets than they give to people. Maybe you do.
And I should know it, because I've killed many dogs.
I'm Casey Kasem. Scooby is vulnerable and lovable and not brave and very much like the kids who watch. Ooh, that's a harsh truth, Casey. But like kids, he likes to think he's brave. Casey Kasem's view of the human condition is troubling. I am legally obligated to mention the bizarre circumstances of Casey Kasem's death, or rather his post-death. When the beloved Top 40 DJ died in 2014 at the age of 42, a fierce feud erupted between his adult children and his second wife, Jean Thompson, an actress who had a recurring part on the sitcom Cheers. Citing disagreements over the funeral arrangements and millions of dollars worth of life insurance benefits, Thompson had Kasem's remains transported from Washington State to Montreal and finally to friggin' Norway, where he was ultimately buried in Oslo for some reason that I don't fully understand. To great controversy, more than 6 months after his death, they kept him on ice for 6 months and shipped him all around God's green earth.
Honey, I finally want to see Norway. I don't care how you get me there.
Want to be buried by the fjords.
The show also had a fairly insane roster of guest stars, including Sonny and Cher in The Secret of Shark Island, which... Cher had such a good time doing that she returned to the franchise in 2021.
It's 50 years later. I don't know how good a time she might have had.
You know, sometimes actors take a long time to come back to their most favorite, the roles that took the most out of them. Don Knotts joined the Scooby Gang for two adventures, playing a detective who looks exactly like Don Knotts in Guess Who's Not Coming to Dinner, and I guess you can take a wild guess at how that's spelled. And then he also returned for a fairly obvious rip of his Andy Griffith Show character in The Spooky Fog of Juneberry. Probably my favorite of these, Mama Cass Elliot showed up in The Haunted Candy Factory. She was in A Haunted Candy Factory, but the name of the episode was The Haunted Candy Factory. She owned The Haunted Candy Factory,
which was
the title of the show.
I don't like, well, you give Mama Cass a candy factory owner? Oh, she just deserves better than that.
Also, the Three Stooges appeared on two 1972 TV movies, while Laurel and Hardy, long after their deaths, popped in for the season one episode Ghost of Bigfoot. Other notable guest stars include Dick Van Dyke, the Harlem Globetrotters, country shred guitarist Jerry Reed, and in more recent years, Steve Buscemi and Whoopi Goldberg. Also, horror legend Vincent Price got his own standalone movie, 13 Ghosts of Scooby-Doo, in 1985. Lastly, for this section anyway, we arrive at the gang's faithful steed and their reeking home away from home, the Mystery Machine. The Green Van was eventually given a history of its own in the fifth episode of the 2002 incarnation of the show on the WB, What's New, Scooby-Doo. The previous owners of the band were revealed to have been a popular family band known as the Mystery Kids, with the van being painted by Flash Flanagan, the band's pianist. In the episode, the van, currently owned by the actual Mystery Gang, seems to be possessed by ghosts, until what else? It is revealed to have been the machinations of the mother of the Mystery Kids, sabotaging the van in an attempt to bring the band back to fame. Anyway, as far as what kind of van the Mystery Machine could actually be, the fine folks at Auto Week broke it down far better than people like you and I, who don't actually know the right end of a dipstick, could. In the early run of Scooby-Doo, Where Are You?, the van was either a mid-60s Chevy G-body panel van or a Dodge A100. Both of these look similar to the Mystery Machine, both have round headlights. The Ford Econoline is also a model mentioned frequently by fans. It had round headlights, but a distinct housing to those headlights that disqualifies it.
Yeah, that was always my assumption, that it was a Ford Econoline van. That was what my dad had in the early 70s, and he tricked it out by cutting a skylight in the roof and putting a bubble window on it, and he put shag carpeting all along the walls and ceiling and put a bed back there, and he called it Marigold the Octopus. That was what he called his van, because it was 1973. I have so many unanswered questions, but
I don't think we're gonna get there.
It's probably best.
Sorry. Probably best we don't. Maybe just keep that one for therapy. In the late 90s, Scooby-Doo on Zombie Island, a direct-to-video feature film, the van looks more like a minivan, perhaps a Chevy Astro or a GMC Safari, and it's painted as a news van for Daphne Blake's fictional show, Coast to Coast with Daphne Blake. Fred is her producer. In 2008's direct-to-DVD animated movie, Scooby-Doo and the Goblin King, the Mystery Machine is turned into a monster called the Monstrous Machine. So there you have it. In 2002, for the live-action movie, the Mystery Machine is portrayed as a 1972 Bedford CF. Bedford was a brand manufactured by Vauxhall. It's never mentioned how an allegedly 17-year-old teen would have gotten his hands on an imported van, but Fred and Daphne do travel to Australia in the aforementioned Coast to Coast with Daphne Blake, so maybe the Bedford is a nod to that particular continuity. Now, obviously, there have been many fan-made versions of the Mystery Machine throughout the years, but perhaps the most famous one may have been driven by 51-year-old Sharon Turman, who led police on a chase in 2016 while high on meth, driving a minivan styled just like the Mystery Machine. She was sentenced to over 2 years in prison.
Ma'am, I'm sorry. This van is just too cool to be street legal. I'm so sorry. I have not heard that, and that very much seems like something I would have heard of. That's incredible.
I'm sure if she won't be the last, I'll just say.
Yeah. To lead police in a high-speed chase in a Mystery Machine? Yeah, no. I mean, trust me. No one else will. I will. That's how I'm going out.
As you meditate on that, we'll be right back with more Too Much Information after these messages.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
When you have health insurance, it's easy to think, I'm covered, no worries. Well, not so fast. Remember, your out-of-pocket costs are not covered by insurance. That can be a lot of money for your family. But how do you know you're not being overbilled? It's estimated that over 50% of medical bills contain errors. Unless you're a billing expert, how do you know your medical bills are accurate? HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your insurance. When your medical claims come in, HealthLock technology reviews the claim for errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. HealthLock makes it easy to find and fix hidden errors, so you pay only what you owe. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. To date, HealthLock has helped its members save over $130 million. Bottom line, insurance alone isn't enough. To save, visit HealthLock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider. That's HealthLock.com.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Now we're going to a section we like to call Scooby-Dooby Sound. Interesting historical note, Scooby-Doo was actually the first Saturday morning cartoon to feature a laugh track. To make sure television audiences laughed at the, you know, in quotes, right moments and did so at proper levels and volumes, TV producers in the 50s started substituting their own canned laughter using a laughing machine invented by Charles Douglas that came to be called the Laugh Box, laugh with two Fs. This is shocking to me because I assumed it was just something that they just dubbed in post and really wasn't that complex, but it was a literal machine. While the Flintstones also used the laugh track, Scooby-Doo holds the distinction of being the first Saturday morning cartoon to harness the canned laughter. Heil, tell us about the laugh box, not to be confused with Peter Frampton's squawk box. Ha, 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 ha.
That's a talk box.
Oh, yeah, you're right, sorry.
Wrong gawk. The history of the laugh box is amazing. Charles Douglas had a team of certified laugh boys, and you bet it. You bet your bottom dollar, buddy. Laugh boys is spelled with two Fs.
Are we the laugh boys?
Yes. Yes, we are. They were certified techs who were allowed to operate the laugh box in his absence.
Allowed to operate.
Well, Douglas had this thing, had the laugh track game on lock throughout the 70s, and he basically took this thing, and it was over 2 feet tall, in an exterior box secured with padlocks, and one of the descriptions that I read operated like an organ. I don't quite know what that means, but basically, Douglas would roll this thing into a studio, and the producer would say, okay, we need a subdued laughter there. We need the quiet tittering there. And Douglas would go to work on it in private to guard his techniques and technology.
It's like the Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, only his immediate family knew what the inside of the machine looked like. And it was referred to at one point as, allegedly, the most sought-after but well-concealed box in the world.
Never mind.
Yeah, I guess. So my guess is that this thing, when they say it operates like an organ, it's just triggering different tapes that he would combine.
Yeah. Like a Mellotron.
Yeah, essentially. And anyway, one of these was discovered and put on Antiques Roadshow at one point. They said you can probably get around 10 grand for it. So there's your belongs in a museum segment for this episode.
There's an episode of the Decoder Ring podcast. There's a whole half hour episode about this machine. Wow. Yeah, I want to check this out later. This is really wild looking. Yeah, and I remember, I think it was Andy Kaufman or somebody who pointed out that part of their hatred of laugh tracks, in addition to it just being inauthentic, was that the voices that you're hearing were recorded many, many, many decades ago, and that they were just all dead by that point, which added a whole other level of creepiness to the mechanical laughter.
I think I read that Chuck Palahniuk book.
Oh, maybe that was it.
Just sort of the most normie alt dickhead to have been reading as a teen. Anyway, as for the non-dialogue sounds of Scooby-Doo, as you might have guessed, for a show originally pitched as a ripoff of the Archies, there were a number of musical considerations that went into the gang's adventures. The original theme song for the show wasn't even the one that people are familiar with today. Scooby-Dooby-Doo, where are you? Got some work to do now. It was basically sounded like the Munsters theme.
Oh, which then got sampled by Fall Out Boy. Uma Thurman? Yeah.
Scooby-Doo, where are you?
However, this version, the instrumental version, only appeared in the first two episodes because the network thought that it was too spooky for children. So this was replaced by a more kid-friendly theme. Now, this is an example of the insane timelines that this used to operate under. The original version of that song is almost lost to history because when the original show, the original two seasons were remastered and re-released in 1998 for home media, they used the second incarnation of the theme song for every episode, almost losing this first one for history. And that instrumental was written by a guy named Ted Nichols, who worked at Hanna-Barbera for nearly a decade, contributed to a ton of the company's shows. Just a fun note about him, he used to sing in a barbershop-styled Dapper Dan quartet at Disneyland. And he got his gig at Hanna-Barbera when a member of the church choir he was musical director of introduced him to him.
The show's more familiar theme song, the one you so indelibly sang a moment ago, was written by David Mook and Ben Raleigh. Raleigh seems to be the more famous of the pair, having written hits like Wonderful, Wonderful for Johnny Mathis, Tell Laura I Love Her, you know, one of those great classic teen death songs of that era, and similar You'd Say Dreck, I Say Classics for Leslie Gore. According to Rosemary Mook, David Mook's widow, he had done some work for Hanna-Barbera before when they assigned him the role of a new theme song for Scooby-Doo, pairing it with Ben Raleigh. The two men met on a Tuesday and completed a new draft of the song in time for the episode that aired that Saturday. They met on a Tuesday. It was on the air on Saturday. That means they wrote it and recorded it, mixed it, mastered it, stuck it on the episode. That's insane. That is totally nuts. It was sung by a guy named Larry Marks. That's the voice who sings the famous Scooby-Doo theme. Marks had been working for Lee Hazlewood, of all people, who was, to me, best known. I mean, has a lot of great mid-60s production partnerships, but the most famous one is with Nancy Sinatra.
Yeah, So Gold.
That's nuts to me. And known for his 3.5-octave voice, Larry Marks came in and knocked out the Scooby-Doo theme on a Wednesday, the day after the two guys wrote it. And it was in place for the series in time for the third episode airing that Saturday.
That is just nuts. And yeah, he had this 3.5-octave voice, so he sang male and female parts in falsetto. But just not, every part on that track is him.
That is wild.
And Jordan.
Yes.
This will interest you. Before the Manson murders, Mook's widow recalled David telling her that Charles Manson had come into David's office peddling demos he'd written. Yeah, she said in an interview, David looked at him and thought, this is a very strange person. I've got to get him out of my office.
They all say that. I think he was much more connected to the 60s music industry than people want a lot on. The only guy who admits that he was like really ingrained in the scene was Neil Young. Everybody else tries to like whitewash him out of the picture. But no, he was hanging out with a lot of, I mean, the Beach Boys, Brian Wilson, Dennis Wilson's the most famous. I think he was hanging out with some of the Mamas and the Papas, like. No, Manson was in the scene, but whatever. Scooby-Doo guy. Larry Marks' version of the Scooby-Doo Burn. Theme song was replaced by a newer version, a better version, a faster version, sung by George A. Robertson Jr., stage named Austin Roberts, who also sang some of the chase music in the second season of the show.
That's the music that kicks up when they're running in between the hallways and out of doors.
Can you do it?
No.
Oh. I'm such a Scooby-Doo noob. I'm not totally sure what it is. Like, I can kind of approximate it, though. Danny Jansen was the producer for the show's music at that point, and he was already an industry vet. He'd written Come On, Get Happy for the Partridge Family and was involved in Josie and the Pussycats. Supposedly, he threatened to walk away from the latter because the network was leery of one of the singers he wanted, Patrice Holloway, who'd become the first ever African-American woman to star in a cartoon.
I just want to stress how cool this guy, Danny Jansen, was. He threatened to walk away because they weren't going to let a black woman onto a cartoon show. And he produced Kurt Russell's 1970 self-titled record.
What does Kurt Russell's record sound like? Is it like a singer-songwriter thing? Yeah, well, I mean, I've never heard him sing. I didn't know he sang. I hope it's like him and a guitar.
Baby, Believe Me.
Oh, that doesn't sound
good.
Is
one of the songs.
Oh, so he's in his Disney phase. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's the craziest thing I've learned on this.
I just love how these industries were so connected.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the truly, if there's any truly magical magic in LA, it's that you can have, you know, a guy who made cartoon history by pushing for the first black representation on a cartoon show and working on something that was written by another guy who'd been pitched by Manson and it's sung by another guy who did guide vocals for Kurt Russell. It's just, what a wacky town.
Now we're heading into a section that you call Scooby-Dooby Reception. Ken Spears, one of the producers of the show, said, "We were worried it wouldn't last but one season, much less than 38 years. It was up against the Hardy Boys on NBC, and we thought we'd get clobbered in the ratings." This did not happen. Nielsen Ratings reported that as many as 65% of Saturday morning audiences were tuned into CBS when Scooby-Doo was being broadcast.
Insane market share.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. At the end of the first season, the original voice of Daphne, Stephaniana Christofferson, which definitely seems like a made-up name, retired and was replaced by Heather North, who voiced the character until 1997. The show was such a success that it stopped being a ripoff of the Archies and Dobie Gillis and became a trendsetter of its own. Hanna-Barbera and its rivals produced a glut of animated programs that also starred teenage detectives solving mysteries with a pet or mascot. These shows included Josie and the Pussycats, The Funky Phantom, The Amazing Chan-Chan and the Chan Clan, Goober and the Ghost Chasers, Captain Caveman and the Teen Angels. One of these is a fake. I know one of these you put in here.
I was just about to say those are all real shows.
In the fall of 1972, Hanna-Barbera and CBS embarked on a new format, one-hour episodes called the New Scooby-Doo Movies, which started the parade of guest stars. After two seasons and 24 episodes of the new movies format in 1972 and 1973, CBS began airing reruns of the original Scooby-Doo Where Are You series until its option on the series expired in 1976. That was around the same time that Fred Silverman, who we mentioned earlier in the episode, kept jumping TV networks during the 70s, became president of ABC, moving from CBS to ABC. And Silverman made a deal with Hanna-Barbera to bring Scooby-Doo to ABC along with him. It began airing in 1976, and it was around this era that Scooby was joined by a new Hanna-Barbera show, Dino-Mutt Dog Wonder, to create the Scooby-Doo Dino-Mutt Hour. What are you having me read?
I just want you to keep reading obscure 60s and 70s cartoons cold. It's really the biggest joy of my day.
Joe Ruby and Kevin Spears, some of the creators of Scooby-Doo, who are now working for Fred Silverman as supervisors of the ABC Saturday morning cartoon lineup, returned the program to its original format, half hour, notably adding Scooby's dim-witted country cousin, Scooby Dumb.
Also not a thing we made up.
The following year, those two, Joe Ruby and Ken Spears, left to start their own studio in 1977 as competition against Hanna-Barbera, which I'm kind of shocked that they didn't have that in their contract not to do. And this is when things started to go downhill for poor Scooby and his friends. By 1979, ratings were so low that the series was nearly axed. So Joseph Barbera and Mark Evaner developed Scrappy-Doo, Scooby's nephew, to prevent ABC from canceling the series. The character, obnoxiously brash and fearless, though physically small, was the other rubric pitch for Scooby-Doo before they ultimately went with large but scared as the core and really only personality traits. 16 episodes of Scooby-Doo and Scrappy-Doo aired during the 1979-1980 season, but ABC ultimately felt that Scrappy was not a positive influence on kids. Evaner wrote about the experience on his blog, quote, "It dawned on ABC broadcast standards that maybe Scrappy was a bad role model for the kiddos. He was, and one person in that department actually used this term to me, quote, too independent. The network also thought Scrappy was, quote, too rebellious. But all that said, Scrappy did exactly what he was supposed to do. As Evaner wrote, he got Scooby-Doo renewed for another season. More Scooby-Doo came from the blood of Scrappy-Doo." In case you haven't figured this out, Scrappy-Doo was fairly hated among Scooby-Doo heads. Series creators Joe Ruby and Ken Spears have gone on the record about having hated him. And so did animator Iwo Takamoto, who describes Scrappy as, quote, definitely not my favorite member of the Scooby family. In 2004, when Scooby-Doo received acclaim for being the animated show with the most episodes, presumably before The Simpsons took that record over, fans congratulated the show but didn't hide their vitriol for Scrappy, with comments like, please let Scrappy get caught by the dog catcher, and any true Scooby fan would have to disregard all the episodes featuring the terrible Scrappy-Doo. It's just too painful. Clearly, they made their opinions very clear.
I love when people get out of pocket about things that do not matter.
Hey, that's the name of this show.
That's true.
James Gunn, who we mentioned earlier, wrote the live-action Scooby-Doo movie, went so far as to call Scrappy-Doo, quote, a little piece of in his movie's twist ending. Scrappy actually winds up being the villain. The film's director, Raja Gosnell, told E, Scrappy ruined the series. So it was just a brainstorm between James and I where we were trying to figure out the final twist. So just out of the session, it was like, Scrappy. I know people younger than us that really like Scrappy. The twist was widely debated on what era of Scooby you watched. But enough people hated Scrappy, so we were mostly applauded. Scrappy-Doo was eventually killed, at least non-canonically, in 2011. In a work of online fan fiction, which tied the show to Dexter, the show about a serial killer with a heart of gold, question mark?
That's why I love fanfic.
Yeah, yeah. By 2014, the out-of-context line, Scrappy-Doo found dead in Miami, had become a Twitter joke. I don't remember that. You're much more online than me. You remember that?
No, I don't remember this one in particular, but I find it so amazing. To recap, someone online was writing fanfic, Dexter fanfic, and the murder that Dexter is investigating in on Scrappy-Doo. I love the internet.
Also in 2011, in an episode of Scooby-Doo Mystery Incorporated, Scrappy appeared in a brief cameo when Fred and Daphne visited a museum celebrating their exploits, to which Fred claims, we all promise each other that we would never speak of him.
It's hard to pin a straight narrative onto the decline and subsequent expansion of Scooby-Doo, simply because, as you may have gleaned already, the show was mercilessly shoved in any direction that whoever owned it at the time thought could make them money. The last incarnation of the show on ABC was called A Pup Named Scooby-Doo, and rode on the then-prevalent trend of making established children's television characters young, a la Muppet Babies. After the show's first season, in 1988, Tom Ruger, who had previously been the head story editor on Scooby-Doo since 1983, took much of his team to defect from Hanna-Barbera to Warner Brothers to develop Steven Spielberg Presents Tiny Toon Adventures, and later Animaniacs and Pinky and the Brain. So that's just a fun historical note that this weird guy worked on two different things about making cartoon characters babies and had enough people on the team to want to continue doing that with him.
I just love that Steven Spielberg felt strongly enough about Tiny Toon Adventures to get branded with his name on it. Yeah.
Jesus. This infantilized Scooby marched on until 1991, but following the success of the show's reruns and live-action film, the next version was What's New, Scooby-Doo, airing on Kids WB from 2002 until 2006. From there, the franchise has traveled to Cartoon Network, Boomerang, which is a cable and streaming app that apparently exists, and finally HBO Max, where Mindy Kaling's adult-oriented Velma, a rebooted version of the show centered on that character, premiered in January of 2023. There's also an entire cottage industry of comic books and video games based around Scooby-Doo that we will not be mentioning.
Oh, I feel bad taking Alex's fan theory corner from you. Do you want to do this?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. One thing we did want to note is some of the more hilarious fan theories about Scooby-Doo. For example, there's a theory that Scooby-Doo is able to speak English because he was part of a Soviet experiment. I like that one.
Mm-hmm.
Or that the gang is actually constantly on the move in the Mystery Machine because the draft dodgers avoiding the Vietnam War. I like that one, too. That's also
I also
really
like good. That one. Yeah. Yeah.
But the award for the most, as you describe it, Baroque theory goes to the one that posits that the characters were based on the Five College Consortium. Jeez, where did you find this? Amherst College has a very preppy reputation, so that represents Fred. Hippie Shaggy is Hampshire College. Mount Holyoke College matches upper class, upper crust Daphne. Smith College is nerdy Velma. And Scooby is UMass Amherst, which is known for partying. Yes, it is. A lot of friends who went there. However, fact check. Hampshire College didn't even open until 1 year after Scooby started airing.
Yeah, you idiots.
Yeah, you proof this stuff. One of the animators shot down the rumor in his autobiography, writing, "I don't think I could have named five colleges in the Boston area, let alone been familiar enough with them to copy their styles." Busted.
So, there you have it, folks. We will chase down any dumb thing that shows up on a listicle. I'm not even sure how that, the genesis of that theory, but we will run it down and fact check it for you. Anyway, despite its massive success, Scooby-Doo has only been nominated for two major awards, a Daytime Emmy in 1990 for A Pup Named Scooby-Doo, and another in 2003 for the voice of Velma, Mindy Kahn, for outstanding performance in an animated program. It's not like the property was ever going to be a critical darling. A.O. Scott once sniffed in the New York Times that Scooby-Doo was, quote, "one of the cheapest, least original products of modern American juvenile culture."
Ouch. I mean, I'm not a huge fan, but there's got to be way more deserving targets than Scooby-Doo.
I just like that he went for that one.
Yeah, that feels personal. That feels like a him problem, honestly.
I would, though, a good counterpoint comes from none other than Carl Sagan, who in his last book hyped Scooby-Doo as approaching the supernatural with a healthy degree of scientific skepticism, which he said the X-Files did not do. He called Scooby-Doo a public service in which paranormal claims are systematically investigated and every case is found to be explicable in prosaic terms. Thank you, Carl.
Billions and billions of ghosts.
Obviously, Scooby-Doo's massive success has more to do with its impact on culture. I mean, you look at something like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which is one of the biggest television hits of the waning days of the 20th century into the 21st. And that is explicitly modeled after Scooby-Doo by Joss Whedon, admittedly. The gang even calls themselves the Scoobies. Yeah.
Huh.
I read an interesting think piece in The Atlantic, which you'll probably never hear me say again, about some of the societal underpinnings of the gang. Fred and Daphne, with their implied coupledom and relatively straight appearances, minus the ascot, represent the upstanding mainstream America, while Shaggy and Velma, with their implied drug habits and obscured sexuality, are the products of the counterculture. Writer Christopher Orr continues, "The show's longevity demonstrates that the metaphor works equally well as outsiders versus popular kids, or, most primally, as children versus parents." And I think that really gets at the essence of Scooby-Doo. Like another totemic illustrated work, Calvin and Hobbes, it captures a representative handful of American archetypes and their companions as they navigate the adult world. Scooby-Doo's ultimate lesson, though, I think is far more cynical than anyone ever let on. The fun evils of the world, like ghosts, vampires, and ghouls, are ultimately all in our heads. And growing up means learning that every spooky thing haunting your imagination via the dark hallways of the world is, in the end, just another greedy adult in a cheap mask. But there's a silver lining in that it also teaches us we'll always have our friends, animal and otherwise, a good sandwich or two, and a pretty sweet van with a custom paint job to help us muddle our way through. Folks, thank you for listening. This has been Too Much Information. I'm Alex Heigl.
And I'm Jordan Runtog. We'll catch you next time.
We'll catch you next time.
Too Much Information was a production of iHeartRadio.
The show's executive producers are Noel Brown and Jordan Runtog.
The show's supervising producer is Michael Alder June.
The show was researched, written, and hosted by Jordan Runtog and Alex Heigl.
With original music by Seth Applebaum and the Ghost Funk Orchestra. If you like what you heard, please subscribe and leave us a review. For more podcasts on iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.